was that ant that stood up to me.
Yeah, but we can forget about him.
Yeah, it was just one ant.
Ooh, one ant.
Yeah, you're right. It's just one ant.
Yeah, boss, they're puny.
Hmm, puny? Say, let's pretend this brain is a puny little ant.
Did that hurt?
Nope.
Well, how about this one?
Are you kidding?
Well, how about this?
You let one ant stand up to us, then they all might stand up.
Those puny little ants outnumber us 100 to 1. And if they ever figure that out, there goes our way of life.
It's not about food. It's about keeping those ants in line. That's why we're going back.
Does anybody else want to stay?
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission:
to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Crap.
Operator, give me the number for 911.
7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. Blast off!
I got a laptop. I make music with my friends. I've got a laptop, baby. I make music with my friends. There it is.
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch it.
Said that we have problems that need to be resolved. So Shaziz Mad Science is here to help in finding the solutions. So anyway, you can get a hold and listen in on the Shaziz Mad Science Show Saturdays 8 a.m. to 11 a.m. Central Time. And don't forget that on Sundays you can also listen in to the Knights of the Round Table where we might not necessarily talk much about science on Sundays. It's a deal about finding solutions in the world. Got some wonderful knights that joined me on that show. So please join in same time, 8 a.m. To 11 a.m. Central. I hope to see you there. Peace and love, everybody. So with that said, the secrets are in the details. This is number two. I did one other show about this. And so I want to point out a few things, and I want to play you a couple podcast kind of things to kind of let you hear some things. If you see, I've learned on this journey of trying to find alternative, free energy, green energy, whatever you want to call it. The fact is, if you can't find free energy, you're simply not looking hard enough. First, you got to have an understanding on how things actually work in order to be able to assess the situation to the extent where now you can try to make this thing more efficient than it was before. See, in a battery, there's a whole lot more power than you could imagine in a battery. It's not the fact that we don't have enough power, it's that we're not using it properly. So when you use any type of energy, you generate a byproduct such as heat, you know, friction, rubbing your hands together, your hands start getting warm and that kind of stuff. Well, if it's cold out your place like it is at mine, today you'll be rubbing your hands briskly, you know, for a long period of time and, you know, doing that body shake to try to build up some heat in your body to keep you warm and all that kind of stuff. But anyway, anytime you use any type of energy, you're going to generate heat. Well, if you use an energy improperly, you're going to generate a lot of heat. See, there's this thing called resistance. Resistance is the, like, you know, we got two different types of wire that can be used for heating elements. There's probably more out there. I mean, just about any of them could be used for a heating element if used properly. But the two major types are tungsten wire and nichrome wire. Well, these are basically designed to resist current flow. You know, all those electrons that trying to get down through that wire all at one time, and the more you try to shove through there, the hotter the wire gets. Well, there's other ways to actually get that wire hot, but you know, it doesn't take near the amount of current, and it doesn't work exactly the way that the wire was actually designed to resist current. When you get resistance, that's where you get the problem started, where they start generating the heat. And that excess heat right there is eventually going to damage whatever appliance that you want to keep. You know, your electric fans, your electric motors, all these kind of different things that use electricity, even your computers. Your computers don't need near the amount of power that we're pushing to them. I mean, we're pushing a constant, if you live over here in the States, we push a constant 120 volts at 60 hertz straight at that doggone device, even though if you actually look at how that device functions, it's stepping this voltage down. It's got resistors in it. It's got step-down transformers. It brings that voltage down to what that computer actually really needs to run. For example, the hard drive in there, 12-volt. You know, you're running a 12-volt hard drive off of 120 volts AC. You're cramming a lot of power to that doggone device. Well, the problem is, whatever that device can't use, that energy's got to find a place to go somewhere. And so it's bouncing back and forth between the wall. And that resistance, all that energy trying to get through there, is actually causing it to get hot. And since everything has a thermal breakdown point where eventually it will fail, you know, metals will get softer and the harder metal will start eating into the softer metal and so on down the line. So we actually, in a lot of our machinery and electric devices, have basically a sacrificial style metal, some softer metal that, you know, you could replace if you get to it in time. And so you know, they're like slip bearings or something like that. As long as it's lubricated, this bearing will last a long, long time. But the moment the lubrication fails, this bearing will start to develop heat from the friction, the harder metal rubbing across it, and then eventually that softer metal will give way. Well, if you catch it in time, you can replace that bearing before you actually destroy the shaft that was running through that bearing. The same thing applies with all your appliances and everything like that. When you're constantly pushing all this power through, you got a thermal breakdown point. You find that thermal breakdown point from the weakest point, and that's where you got to start to protect that device if you want it to have longevity. So the deal is, it's not that we don't have enough power, it's that we're not using it properly. We're trying to use too much power to run things that don't require nowhere near the power that we're pushing to them. And my hopes is so that I can show people, because they're saying that the problem with alternative energy is that we need storage. We ain't got batteries that'll last long enough. That's because those batteries, they have more power than you can imagine. They're trying to balance themselves out. See, nature wants to balance everything out back to its natural state. So when you have a charged battery, that's not a natural state. That's why you just threw an imbalance in there. Well, nature wants to put all that electrons, everything back into its balance. And so it's waiting for the opportunity to allow that energy to flow from one side to the next and level everything out. It's like if you connect two buckets of water together and you got a line in there and the water is higher in one bucket and lower in the other bucket, that pressure will actually push that water until both of those buckets have the same amount of water in there. And so with that said, the same thing applies with electricity. So when you have that imbalance in a battery, if you have two batteries, it's going to act just like that bucket, those two buckets of water. It's going to balance it out. So both of these batteries have the same amount of energy, and when they're completely balanced out, that's what we call a dead battery. That's mind-blowing, ain't it? Because those plates are already back to where they were originally before you actually put the charge on them. So understanding that and understanding how this energy is moving around, that's how we're going to get to more efficient devices. When they talk about how we need storage for alternative energy, why solar is supposedly intermittent because the sun's only out so long during the day, or wind power or whatever. Well, what they're overlooking is that if you understand how that energy is actually being used by the device itself, you can get that device to run on much less than it is and more efficiently than it does, and shorten that path so that those batteries don't go back to, you know, their balance, which is basically a dead battery, so fast. They last longer is what I'm trying to say. You know, you can regulate that flow. And so if you can do that with water, you can also do that with electricity. Water and electricity and air pressure is amazing because they all have the same physics involved. They all have pressure. Large volume of it would be the current flow that you're used to as far as electricity goes. But the thing is, you don't need that much current. So with today's show, I'm going to start off in playing some things about welding, because welding is a pretty impressive process where you can join different materials together. And if you understand some chemistry and some other types of physics, you can put two pieces of metal together that don't normally jive with each other by putting some sort of metal in between them that will work with both of them. And so there's ways to weld aluminum to steel and stuff like that. The science of welding is getting really intense, not to mention the fact that they have different types of resins and different types of glues today that are just, mind-blowingly incredible technology. Folks, we got all the answers necessary to resolve these problems. And the reason why I do the Mad Science Show is because I want to be able to try to take every bit of knowledge that I've got in my mind and all these research that I've done and all these different people out here. Stephen Givens, he's always in the chat room out there. Awesome person. He's done some amazing work. If you're in the Super Chat room, scroll up there to the buttons at the top, and you'll see Stephen's resource page. He spent a lot of time and effort to put together a whole bunch of different alternative energy research links to researchers and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, if you can, go over there and take a look at it. And then, whenever you see what he's done, you know, throw him a compliment up there in the chat room, because he really worked hard. He didn't have to do that. See, the things that we do between People for People Radio Network and Shaziz Radio, we're doing it to try to help our brothers and sisters out there. We're trying to make this world a better place, one positive pebble at a time. And so, you know, when Mad Science School's in session, I hope to try not to bore you to tears today, but there's some things that you get. There's the secrets are in the details. If you go back and listen to a lot of these old how-tos and military, you know, videos about training and all that kind of stuff, and you listen really closely to what's going on, you start having some aha moments. Some lights start coming on. And so I'm kind of like really getting impatient. I'm trying to get my lab, my newest lab, together, you know, because I had, if you go watch that doggone video I put out there, Forces of Darkness, I had some flooding and mold issues in my old lab, and it's all a mess, and not, you know, and I kind of crammed myself into a little room where you've seen the last few live streams, but I've tried to show you bits and pieces of what it is that I'm actually working on. Yeah, so, you know, when it comes down to trying to put a device into everyone's hands, I'm wanting to do this. I'm just as impatient as you are. As soon as I get this lab together, I'm going to be able to have the working conditions necessary to start showing you these things, exactly what I'm talking about, and putting them into practice so that you can actually physically see them. But I don't want you to just be able to see them. I want you to understand how they work and know that they do work. I'm not here to try to scam anybody. I'm not here to try to sell anybody anything. I'm trying to sit here and show you real science. Mainstream science seems to have basically sold their soul to the devil, as far as I'm concerned, because they should know what I'm telling you. They should have already, you know, moved in this direction to try to make things so incredibly efficient that not only do they last longer, but it makes it so that you don't have to use near the amount of energy. I mean, after all, they're the ones saying that we got to reduce our carbon footprint, while they go out there and, you know, use all the hypocrisy in the world doing whatever it is they so choose, you know, flying in corporate jets and limousines. And even the environmentalists out there doing the same doggone thing, complaining all the time. Well, we don't want to complain here at the Shaziz Radio Mad Science Show. We don't want to complain. We want solutions. We want to put solutions on the table. Look, if that didn't work, let's try this over here. Let's do it. We got the physics, we got the science, we got the mechanics, and out there with all of you, we have the talent as well. We have everything necessary to fix it. It's a case of all we got to do is come together and put our talents, our skills together and make this thing work. But if we don't even have an understanding of how things work, you know, I've tried to find things that don't have such high-tech terminology, because I don't want the average Joe to be, you know, blown away by all this big terminology, because it's not necessarily, it's not nowhere near as complicated as it sounds. You know, it's like you trying to talk to a doctor or read Latin. If you don't understand the doctor's lingo or the Latin, or even me trying to communicate with the mainstream science guy trying to tell him stuff, they only know what the book says. They got the terminology, they got their own language, and so with that said, anybody outside that realm, maybe even your mechanic or whatever, you know, you might think it's a thingamajigger, and they don't know what the heck a thingamajigger is, so you just point it out and they say, oh, that's a carburetor. Yeah, well, it's leaking. So if you had that terminology and you understood their language, you could talk back and forth to each other and troubleshoot things. But that's the problem with our society. They don't teach everybody the things like they used to teach everybody. So, you know, that's what we're hoping to do here at Mad Science Show. We're trying to teach each other. We're trying to help each other learn and troubleshoot stuff. So If you got people out there who's really interested in fixing this world, send them over here. Send them to People for People Radio Network. All the links are provided here. You can go to Shaziz.com, ShazizRadio.com, Shaziz.net. All of these websites are going to have their own specific purpose. You got chat rooms. You got ways to communicate, ways to share information and all that kind of stuff. And that's the only thing we ask of anybody who comes here and listens to this radio show. Come in here, listen in. If you like what you hear, share the information. You know, that's what it's all about. Because when we all come together and the average Joe can understand what's being said, you're not blown away by high-tech terminology or somebody trying to make themselves sound smarter than you. We're all talented. We're all gifted. We all have something to add to the machine of making things work. And that's why it is that I do what I do, because I want to bring all these people together. I want to bring the best and most brilliant minds together. And they're not the ones in NASA. They're not the ones in the government. They're not the ones in the corporations. They used to be you. They used to be just like you. And when somebody found out that these people are really good at somebody or some particular task, they snatched them up, took them out there. They pay them a lot of money, and never seen or heard from, you know, again, except for in passing. They're building your building. You don't even realize that you have what it takes to make the world work. That's it. Your job that you may think is insignificant is not. It's important, because without those gears, without the labor, the things that you do, you wouldn't get it done. So anyway, let's get back to this deal, because I want you to hear a few things. And we're starting off with welding, because it's a pretty interesting subject. But like I said, the secrets are in the detail. There is a lot more power than you can possibly imagine in a battery, and even coming out of that wall. So I'm going to start off with this one right here. As soon as it decides to come up. Apparently I got a computer issue where it's taking its sweet time to do what it needs to do. I don't know what's going on there. So, there we go. Come on. That's modern technology for you folks. Alright, any day now. I'm going to have to run a scan on this doggone computer and find out why it's been getting slower and slower. You know, with all the dude jobbers at Skype and everybody has been doing on the spyware and all that kind of stuff, it's actually slowing down this doggone computer. And it's getting aggravating. But, let me see if I can get this doggone thing to go. Anyway. While that thing is still sitting there doing the loop-de-loop, spinning around, like I said, the doggone secrets are in the details. And so if you listen closely to what's being said, and just step outside the box and let your mind go somewhere else, and you'll start to hear a few things. Come on, man! Doggone technology! Oh, I may have to refresh this doggone thing. This is nutty. Alright, let's try that. Are you serious? Hold on, folks. I gotta refresh that doggone browser because something is taking too doggone long. Anyway, so while that's monkeying around, I got all these video links are posted in the chat room, so if you're interested in watching these videos after the deal, then if you jump on the Super Chat room, you'll be able to see them. All right, let's try this doggone thing again. Yo, I tell you, you'd be surprised at how much trouble that I have sometimes trying to hold this duct tape and belting wire together.
I found this microwave in my neighbor's garbage can, so I took it home and turned it into an AC stick welder. In this project, we'll be testing out this contraption to see if it actually works. Because if it does, we'll have the metal welding power to make a puzzle for entertaining guests, or build improvised weapons for a zombie apocalypse. I just modified these microwave oven transformers to weld metal, and made a little container for it all to fit into. This arc welder is finished and ready for testing, so to do that, I got some pieces of scrap metal from a welding shop down the road. I switched out the blade on my chop saw with this cutting wheel, and I'm cutting these bits of steel into smaller pieces. The sparks are pretty hot and fly everywhere, so it's important to wear protection and keep them away from anything flammable. Okay, our pieces are cut and resting on this larger piece of metal. This is going to act as a base plate for the ground clip to connect to. I've got a 6013 welding rod that gets clipped into the stinger, and the amperage is controlled with this device I call the Scariac. Look for how to build this in another video. The amps are adjusted to work with these 16th-inch cellulose-coated rods, and with two of our pieces butted up next to each other, it's time to see if we can strike an arc. They say it's kind of like striking a match, and there we go. These welding rods are consumable, meaning they get used up in the weld. You can actually see where the end of the rod turns to molten metal and pools into the joint. To give this a little more strength, let's flip it over and do the same thing to the top side. The UV radiation from stick welding is enough to give you a pretty bad sunburn, so if you try it, make sure you're protected from head to toe. Alright, the weld is cooled, so now we can knock off the layer of slag that's formed on the top, then clean it up with a wire brush. Now it looks good to me, but I've never really welded before, so I'm not sure how to tell if the weld is good or not. So let's break it. The piece gets clamped in a bench vise, and these channel lock pliers should give us the leverage we need.
I want to pause that just for a second because when you in the process, you heard the man talk about how the UV radiation that comes off of welding is enough to actually give you a sunburn. That's a real kind of deal, and you actually have to wear some special glasses in order to not blind yourself because of the brightness of the light, which tells you there's a whole lot more power going on there than you really think. So let's keep rolling with this.
I'm actually expecting this will snap in the middle, but it didn't. I welded another piece and tried bending it back and forth multiple times to snap the weld, but the joint never broke. Just for fun and a bit more practice, let's weld all the scrap pieces together. I've also got these framing nails we can tack on in random places, and a link of galvanized chain we can weld to the end. Well, I think it's safe to say this welder is working, and I've got my first piece of metal art to prove it. It's a little rough, and probably not the kind of decor I'd want to put on display, but in a weird way, I kind of like it. Now I'm amazed that even with all this welding, the transformer coils are only slightly warm to the touch. I tried welding some larger 332 rods, and that was a different story. They work alright, but the welder heats up fast. To cool it down, I have a fan that was salvaged from one of the microwaves, and it slides right up to the vent hole on the left. When it's turned on, air flows over the transformer coils and exhausts out the other side. In the case of extreme overheating, the whole top lifts right off for a maximum ventilation. This welds metal pretty good in my opinion, but I took it to another welder to get his thoughts on how it worked. He tried some welds on pieces of his own scrap steel, and seemed pretty impressed with the results. He said the weld penetrated the metal completely and probably wouldn't break. So we tried some more destructive testing to break the weld, but even with good leverage and quite a bit of force, the weld held strong and the metal broke first. To finish this project up, let's try making something a little more useful. This time I've got a horseshoe and some chain, and I'm welding the links in line with the tips of the shoe. This 2-inch steel ring goes over both of the chains, and the remaining links are welded onto another shoe. We can clean up the welds in the usual way, and look at that! We've got a horseshoe puzzle ready for entertaining. The challenge is to get the ring off, which seems impossible because the ring is way too small. But it can be done, and my wife just proved it. Why don't you make your own and see if you can figure out how it's done? Well, there's a Mott stick welder that works, and my first few experiences with the world of welding. If you like this project, perhaps you'll like some of my others. Check them out at thekingofrandom.com.
All right, so I like sharing those types of videos with you because, you know, individuals that go out there and they show you how to repurpose different devices that, you know, other people throw away in the trash. When you throw a microwave oven in the trash, there's a whole lot of good parts left in there, parts that you could repurpose for other things or actually use to repair other, you know, appliances and such. So, you know, with that said, now I want to get into another one where this guy's explaining how to weld with batteries.
Okay, I'm going to be demonstrating the proper way to weld two pieces of metal together using just welding rod and rubber cables and batteries. Most of this equipment you're already going to have in your vehicle if you're out on the trail. Every vehicle's got a battery, and if you got more than one guy in your party, then obviously you'll have two batteries.
All right, I got to pause this for a second because I forgot to mention that whenever he welded those pieces of metal, that weld was stronger than the actual metal in that last video there. And you know, there's more to it. So and we'll get back to that later.
Set of jumper cables. Everyone should have a set of those. A pair of vice grips for holding the welding rod, just because the clamps on jumper cables really don't hold welding rods very good. You need a piece of wire to wire the two batteries in series. You can use a second set of jumper cables for this, but I like to just keep a short length of 4 gauge battery cable in my toolbox. You're going to need a welding helmet. Now, since I'm in the shop, I've got my auto-darkening welding helmet here, but you can just get a cheap Harbor Freight one and throw it in your toolbox. And then, of course, the fire extinguisher, just because the grass on trails and hot welding sparks don't mix. You definitely don't want to start a fire. So, and with all this equipment right here, all you got to do is throw in a couple of welding rods and the welding helmet to the gear you already have, and you just added the capability of welding on the trail. Okay, to set this up, you're going to want to disconnect the batteries from both vehicles. You don't want the voltage spikes that go along with welding going through your vehicle's electrical system. Microelectronics and computers definitely don't like that. So, once you got the batteries disconnected, you need to wire them in series so you can get your 24 volts. But I've got my battery cable here, and all I do is connect that from the positive terminal of one battery to the negative terminal of the other one. And you definitely want to make sure that your connections are tight because you're going to be passing potentially a couple hundred amps through this, and a loose connection will melt down your battery terminals on your battery, possibly damage your battery and the cable, and may start a fire as well. So definitely make sure these connections are tight. Okay, once you get your batteries out of the vehicles and hooked up, you're going to go ahead and hook up your jumper cables. You're going to hook the negative cable up to the negative terminal on one battery, and the positive cable up to the positive terminal on the other battery. On the ends of the jumper cables, you're going to want to take your vice grips and hook it up to the negative terminal, and we're going to use our positive terminal to clamp to our workpiece that we're going to be welding on. This polarity is really important. If you do it the other way around, you're not going to get a good weld at all. You're going to get a bunch of splatter, and you're just not going to get the two pieces of metal to stick together. So this is called DC electronegative welding. Now, using this process is a little bit different from normal stick welding. So even if you're familiar with stick welding, you should probably try this in your shop before you rely on it out on the trail. Because we're using essentially a constant voltage source for welding, the arc is a little bit different than what you'd be used to with normal stick welding. So I'm going to go ahead and take my electrode and clamp it here in the vice grips. And just for example, I have a set of brake rotors that's right here. We're going to go ahead and weld these together. On top of the brake rotors right here, and then I'll go ahead and just lay a couple of short beads on the ends to actually stick the two of them together.
want to pause that for a second. As you're watching this video and you're seeing that bright flash of light as he's welding these two brake rotors together, that's a lot of power, folks. There is a whole lot more power in them batteries than you can imagine. So let's keep rolling here.
Yeah, go ahead and use a brush to clean this stuff up. And as you can see, these two pieces are stuck together pretty good now. Okay, and you can see the sample welds I did up here. They're actually pretty clean. I got a little bit of splatter. And then I got my welds right here that are actually holding the two pieces together. I got this one here and this one right here. And they actually came out pretty clean. They're pretty good looking welds. Okay, as you can see, with just the addition of a couple of small pieces of equipment to your toolbox, you can have the ability to weld out on the trail. And that's definitely really handy if you're a long ways away from the shop. So I hope this was useful for everyone.
Oh yeah, it's useful, all right. So basically what that man just did was he took two 12-volt car batteries, ran them in series to equal up to 24 volts DC, and took some jumper cables, heavy-duty wire, and a pair of vice grips to hold the welding rod. And, you know, if you watch it, like I said, the secrets are in the details, but there's enough power in those batteries to weld steel together. Those two steel deals, and he has some really good smooth welds going on there too. So he's pretty dang good at it, with the improvised welding or whatever. But either way, it's worth looking into. So, like I tell you all the time, download these videos, these how-tos, and keep them on hand for just such an emergency that you need, some information or stuff like that. Or at least make you a detailed how-to, write it down in a book or something like that. Because this knowledge could come in handy sometime. But either way, what it does show is that if you understand how energy travels and how this power works, there's a whole lot more that you can do with those doggone batteries than you think. I mean, like I said, when you're watching that weld right there, you heard the last guy in the last video talk about how, the UV lights is enough power to give you a suntan, because you literally have plasma going on, or you got fusion going on, or you're fusing two pieces of steel together. That's a whole lot of power. And so when you get that little bit through your mind right there, and then you start listening into some of the other details, it all start making sense to what I'm trying to get, the point I'm trying to get across to you, because it doesn't take near the amount of power to do what you think to run your doggone appliances. So let's move on with this one right here.
Welding has been around in some form or fashion since the 4th century AD, and modern welding techniques fueled the Industrial Revolution and are crucial to many modern industries. Welding is a very broad term, covering hundreds, if not thousands, of specific materials joining processes. Even if you're not a welder by trade or materials joining engineer, understanding how various materials can be joined is a fairly useful life skill. To start off your understanding of welding processes, let's throw out a bunch of acronyms and terms and then dive into specific processes a little later on. The main welding processes are shielded metal arc welding, gas tungsten arc welding, gas metal arc welding, flux cord arc welding, submerged arc welding, electroslag welding, and lastly, resistance welding. These are only the basic welding methods, and there are many different variations of each, along with techniques that weld using frictions, lasers, and even electron beams. Each process is specifically designed for different metals, and there are even processes that can weld dissimilar metals, like copper and iron. There's no way we can cover an extensive review of every single welding process in this video, but we can probably cover enough so you can keep up in a conversation about welding, if you ever find yourself in one of those. All welding processes induce fusion through some energy source. In other words, the base metal is melted in some way. Processes like shielded metal arc welding use an electrode that melts to induce fusion on the base metal and acts as a filler metal for the joint. Gas tungsten arc welding, or what you might know by the name of TIG welding, uses a tungsten electrode and an inert gas, usually helium, to weld the base metal. What you'll find in common between all of the processes mentioned in this video is that there's some form of arc or electrode being used to spark the fusion reaction, thus the A in all of the acronyms for each technique. The only exception in the list that we provided is resistance welding, which uses an electric current to generate heat through the resistance of two overlapping metals. This is just simply a slightly different use of electricity to weld. Arc welding is the most common, but it's also important to note that there is also gas welding and energy beam welding. These processes use gas or energy beams to heat up the material, rather than current and voltage. Gas and energy methods, while variant, are fairly simple to understand in basic mechanics. Each different arc technique uses a different electrode and a different setup of applying flux to the weld. Flux is a purifying agent that helps welds bond materials and maintain uniform structure, therefore increasing strength. For most of the welding techniques, you can somewhat infer how they work from their names. Flux cord arc welding uses a wire with, you guessed it, a flux core. Contrary to what you might think, submerged arc welding isn't actually an underwater process. It uses a consumable electrode to weld under a blanket of flux, therefore submerging the weld under the flux to keep it safe from the atmosphere. Now that we have some background on all of the various welding techniques, we can begin to understand how to weld various metals. Instead of taking a long time to explain why each welding technique can weld each certain material, we'll pop this quick guide on the screen and go through it pretty fast. Steel can be used with these techniques, stainless steel with these, aluminum with these, cast iron with this one, copper and brass with TIG, magnesium alloy with TIG, and titanium with TIG as well. As you can probably notice, iron-based metals can be welded with various techniques, but other metals can't. That's because they have less compatible cell structures and they take specific techniques to weld. The reason behind both steel's wide range of techniques and other metals' specific techniques has to do with cell structure, phase changes, melting points, and many other factors that we won't get into here. If you want to join two dissimilar metals, say aluminum to steel, welders have to get creative in their techniques. The most common way to weld dissimilar metals or metals not compatible with each other is to use a filler metal that is compatible to both. In the case of aluminum and steel, zinc can be used as a transition metal, or special transition inserts can be fabricated. If you want to learn about the welding of dissimilar metals, these processes are on the cutting edge of materials joining techniques. Groundbreaking research is continually being made in the areas of friction stir welding, laser welding, and even explosive welding. Welding is both an incredibly simple thing to grasp, yet also a process filled with endless complexities and sciences.
So, from that little video right there, you can see there's a lot of different ways that you can actually weld, but they all have one common denominator where they're fusing two materials together. So, you know, it takes a lot of energy to do that, and for like things like steel and different heavy metals like that. But, you know, you can weld plastics and all kinds of stuff. Once you understand the basic mechanics and the basic physics of it, it's not that big a deal. It's not rocket science. But I'm trying to make this a little bit easier for you to understand. But the energy necessary to do this, you know, is the key to, you know, if you want to, you know, clean, renewable, alternative energy, first you got to understand what the heck is going on. How you get so much power out of these devices that you can actually weld two different pieces of metals together, you know, two pieces of steel. It takes a lot of heat to do that. So, you know, there's also, you know, other materials out there, you know, that could be welded together, you know, using different techniques, but it all, you know, boils down to there's a lot of heat energy involved in what's going on. Let's keep rolling with this. This is interesting. History welding
and the related arts of soldering and brazing have been around for a very long time. Welding history is thought to begin around 4000 BC, when the Egyptians started using copper. People started working with bronze between 2000 BC and 3000 BC. During the Bronze Age, small gold circular boxes were made by pressure welding lap joints together. In 1330 BC, Tutankhamun's funeral mask was made using solder and a blowpipe for metal soldering. Welding was used to build the Iron Pillar in Delhi, India, in about 310 AD. The Middle Ages brought advances in forge, in which blacksmiths hammered heated metal repeatedly until bonding occurred. It was not until the 19th century that welding as we know it today was invented. In 1800, Sir Humphry Davy invented the electric arc. The arc was created between two carbon electrodes that were powered by a battery. Humphrey's cousin, Edmund Davy, then discovered the gas acetylene in 1836. But its use was not practical in welding until 1887, when the blowpipe or torch was developed. The torch used acetylene and liquefied air or oxygen to create higher flame temperatures than had ever been reached before. In 1881, carbon arc welding was first used and later became popular during the late 1890s and early 1900s. The first resistant spot welding machines were produced in 1906, allowing welders to weld very thin materials. In 1911, the first pipeline was created using oxyacetylene welding. In 1912, Lincoln Electric began manufacturing the first commercial welding machines. In 1917, because of a gas shortage in England during World War I, electric arc welding became the primary fabrication method to manufacture bombs, mines, and torpedoes. During the 1920s, major advances were made in welding technology, including the introduction of automatic welding in 1920, in which electrode wire was fed continuously. Automatic welding meant that cars could now be produced much faster. In 1926, gamma ray radiation was first used to detect flaws in cast or welded steels, leading to sturdier welds. In 1928, in Pennsylvania, America, the first all-welded railroad bridge was erected. In 1939, the use of aluminum spot welding was first recognized as being useful in aviation. In 1962, during the construction of the Mercury space capsule, due to the small size of each sheet of titanium, NASA used TIG welding to weld the titanium together without a filler metal. In 1966, Jan Stepney founded Welding Alloys Limited. In 1969, the Russians welded in space on Soyuz 6. This was the first time that this had been attempted. Modern-day welding has come a long way. Now we have robotic welding, onboard computers that program the welding, and state-of-the-art electrodes and exotic multiple gas mixtures.
So that's getting a little bit of history of how long welding's actually been around, and you know, you're basically talking about the power of the sun involved in, you know, that doggone welding, because you know, you're using heat to basically fuse these two things together, and in some cases plasma. You know, well, basically you're generating plasma in the process of welding. And so, you know, there's a lot of power involved there, a whole lot of power. So with that said, I want to play this right here.
What's up, YouTube? This is LDS Reliance. We use batteries in our everyday life all the time, but not very many of us know really how they work or understand much about their characteristics. one of the biggest questions that I get asked is about capacity. Capacity means the actual quantity of electricity that you can extract out of a battery from one cycle of fully charged battery to fully discharged battery. So how do we measure capacity? Well, you may have noticed on some batteries, like this power tool battery, a measurement that says 4.0 Ah, or 4.0 amp hours. And an amp hour is the amount of energy charge in a battery that will give you 1 amp or 1 ampere for 1 hour. So that's pretty simple, but unfortunately it gets more complicated. Most battery manufacturers do not all use the same measurement for calculating amp hours or capacity. Some of them will use a 10-hour rate, meaning it takes 10 hours to discharge the battery. Other people will use 20, and others will use 100. So you need to make sure that you look at the fine print on the label. So here's an example of a battery that uses the 100-hour rate. If you were to compare this to a 20-hour battery, you would think that this was much better. However, you need to convert the run rates to the same measurement to be able to compare them accurately. So what does this all mean? Well, let's take a 225 amp hour battery, which is measured at the 20 hour run rate, and do a simple math problem. So you cross out the hours on the top and the bottom, and you divide the top by the bottom, and you get 11.25 amps. And what that means is that this battery is rated to produce 11.25 amps for 20 hours straight. So the last thing that I wanted to mention in this video that's very important is that the more current you draw, the more you lower the capacity of the battery. So in this chart, as you'll see on the right side, the furthermost extreme is 0.33 amps. This battery will run that for 20 hours. But if you were to draw 32.5 amps, it'll only last 4 minutes. So keep that in mind when you're talking about how much battery capacity you need for a specific application. Thanks for watching, guys. We'll see you next time.
Okay, so I want to bring us right back to this point right here. And repeat this one second.
You divide the top by the bottom, and you get 11.25 amps. And what that means is that this battery is rated to produce 11.25 amps for 20 hours straight.
Alright, 11.25 amps for 20 hours straight. You think about that for a second. That's pretty doggone impressive. When they're talking about solar power and they're talking about wind power being intermittent, and that you know, when the sun ain't out or the wind ain't blowing or whatever, that you don't have nothing putting the charge back in that system. Just overnight, you know, you cut the day in half, 12 hours a day, you know, whatever portion of that is dark or whatever, then, you know, you got 20 hours of runtime if all you need is 11.25 amps. You can do a lot with 11.25 amps, a lot more than you think you can. And so with that said, you got 20 hours of time that if you understand a little bit about circuitry and some of the things that Tesla taught about, you know, how to generate wireless AC, or, you know, AC current in general, or even pulse DC for that matter, that you can design specific styles of inverters that will actually take that power that's coming in that battery for 20 hours, pulse in a transformer at 11.25 amps, and you don't even need that maximum. I'm just saying, but that's how much you could run, 11.25 amps for 20 hours at a time, and you can use that to charge up a transformer and a storage bank and so on. That if you understand what I'm saying to you, you already realize that the answers, the secrets are in the details. You already have what you need in order to be able to keep your lights on no matter what happens. Now, like I said, the secrets are in the details. If you look at that battery, it'll tell you how long that battery will last, for how many amps the draw per, you know, hour or whatever. So a 20 amp hour battery will, like you seen when you did the math on there, it will give you 11.25 amps for 20 solid hours. Now, any other draw over the top of that, then you'll obviously shorten that time. But keep in mind, this is just for one battery. And the larger your battery bank is, then the longer that time will last. So a couple batteries in line, if it's a 20 amp battery, it's going to last a lot longer because you have a lot more storage in there. So two of them is going to last a lot longer than 20 hours if you're only drawing what that battery is rated for. And just imagine if you're drawing less than that, what that battery is rated for. This is why I'm trying to explain to you that there's a whole lot more power in them batteries than you can possibly imagine. And if used properly, these batteries could last a long, long time, if not indefinitely. See, the problem with batteries is they got a charge and discharge cycle that, you know, so they're rated for so many charges and so many discharges. You mean you bring it all the way up and all the way down or whatever. You know, that's a cycle. When you drain all that power off and then you recharge it, that's one cycle. It doesn't matter what battery we're talking about, it's all the same exact things. And some of them have a lot longer cycles. Different types of batteries have a lot longer cycles. And if you look at the amp hours on them once again, it'll tell you how many amps that you can draw per hour, how many hours that you can do that for. And so when you go to looking at some of these modern day circuit boards like the RC motor controllers, which is an amazing amazing little circuit, amazing little device, you can do a whole lot more with it. I've already showed a few things. My neodymium magnet accelerator is pretty impressive if you understand what's going on there. So how long could I run that 30 amp little circuit at, you know, 30 amps is maximum that it can actually handle. It doesn't take nowhere near 30 amps to actually run that circuit. But either way, even at 30 amps, how long could I run that doggone thing on one of these batteries and use that that little circuit board, that RC motor controller, to pulse transformers? So once you get that, like I said, the secrets are in the details. If you understand how an inverter works, if you understand how these doggone motor controllers work, all they're doing is they're pulsing coils. That's it. You know, that's their only job. It's taking and flipping the switch on and off, on and off, on and off. And so when you get that down with a custom transformer going on, then now you got the equivalence of basically a miniaturized power station. And so if your solar panels will charge your batteries up during the daytime, and you know that you can get 20 amp hours out of one of these batteries, and it doesn't take you very much power to run whichever circuit you design, and that's a 30 amp one that I was talking about. They come in all different sizes, but you can actually customize your own circuit boards to run on less. And if you're just, because those transformers, they do not care where that magnetic field comes from. They don't care where that power. They're just looking for a change in polarity. And we use a lot of energy to spin rotors around and all this kind of stuff because we don't understand how simple the physics are to it. We don't understand, so we're putting too much power to all these different devices. And that's not excluding your doggone computer or your cell phone. Talk on your cell phone for a while and note that the temperature starts to rise up on there because the way that energy is actually, you know, it's meeting resistance. That battery wants to balance itself back out, and it can't. And so when it does, when it meets that resistance, resistance equals heat, and that's what causes things to get, you know, to the point where they reach the thermal breakdown and fail. Once we understand all that kind of stuff, the rest of it starts to fall into place, and you start to have an aha moment when the lights come on, and you're like, hey, wait a second, I can get the equivalence of the amount of light that I'm using with a tungsten off of LEDs, and I don't even have to use near the amount of electricity to get that amount of light. And, you know, even if you understand how the tungsten element is a resistive element, there are ways by which you can actually use the radio frequency to light that same exact bulb up. I've lit a 12-volt bulb up that was completely... The tungsten element is burned in half. It's a light bulb that come out of the front end of a car. The headlamp burned up. And I set a 20,000-volt Beckett oil burner igniter that runs in the milliamp range. So in the milliamp range, I was able to literally light up a dead light bulb. It shot straight across there. That frequency vibrated that metal inside that vacuum, and it still lit that bulb up. I used it for a vacuum spark gap to keep my, you know, Tesla coils running smoother and stuff like that. But once you understand that right there, everything has a resonant frequency, and if you vibrate it fast enough, that vibration is enough to produce the friction, which in turn produces the heat that causes that thing to light up. So you can light that light bulb up for a lot less. And, you know, with other things like LED or even fluorescent lighting, it doesn't take near the amount of power that you're putting to that 120-volt or 220 ballast, whichever it is in your standard, you know, wherever you're living at. But it don't take near the amount of input in order to get that thing to do what it does. You know, the frequency range of how you energize that gas inside of a fluorescent bulb will determine how bright that thing is. It's just, you know, pretty much... gas smashing around and changing electrons and all this kind of stuff, and it's producing energy, you know, in the form of plasma. So, with that said, let's go on to this one right here.
Wouldn't it be weird if one day in the future you were buying a home and the listing said, batteries not included? Yeah, well, that could totally happen. Hey there, people. Julian here for DNews. Electricity is pretty great. It powers my toaster, my fridge, my hair dryer, my air conditioner, my humidifier, my dehumidifier, and my PC that I use to watch science YouTube videos. I think I'm going to keep using it. The problem is, everyone in all the other houses feels the same way, usually at about the same times of day, and they're driving the cost of those tasty kilowatts up in the evening. Of course, during the day, if you don't want to use power from the grid, you could get some solar panels and harvest sunlight, but that's not helpful when the sun's down. Also known as nighttime. Also known as the time I need to have electricity to turn lights on to not bang my shins on all the furniture. Enter the battery-powered home. The idea is a rechargeable battery stores energy from solar panels during the day or from off-peak hours when grid energy is cheapest and uses that energy during the rest of the day. The problem is, if you've ever bought batteries, you know they cost approximately one arm and or one leg. Elon Musk thought that this was a silly hang-up for what is otherwise a great idea and decided to do something about it. Elon Musk, for y'all that don't know, is basically what would happen if Tony Stark lost the goatee. His interests range from online money movement to commercial spaceflight to, most importantly for this topic, electric cars. His company, Tesla Motors, has been refining electric car batteries for years, engineering them to be lighter, longer lasting, and more efficient. So why don't we take all those batteries and put them on a wall? So they did that. The Tesla Powerwall is basically a bunch of lithium-ion cells in a sleek case. They're compartmentalized and liquid-cooled to solve the knotty problem of overheating and burning your house down, something that is generally undesirable. If you wanted it as your main power supply, there's a model that can store and discharge up to 7 kilowatt-hours daily and costs $3,000. Best of all, it should last 10 years, which is approximately 8 years longer than my laptop battery made it before it couldn't hold a charge anymore. The trick to this longevity is how much power it outputs. It's only pumping out 2 kilowatts continuously, and peak output is 3.3 kilowatts. The problem that then arises is some appliances will use more than that output. An electric clothes dryer could draw that much power on its own. So, if you want to dry clothes, I hope you weren't planning on microwaving a burrito, too. If you wanted to not be reliant on the grid at all, you'd probably need a few...
Pause this just for a second, because what he said was that electric, clothes dryer is going to draw a lot more power. And keep in mind, I'm telling you that inside that clothes dryer is a tungsten element, and if at the right frequency range, you can actually get that thing just as hot for in the milliamp range. So all of these appliances and all these batteries, that what he's talking about right here, will only last you for so long because of the way that you're using that energy. What I'm saying is, that you don't need near the amount of power. So if these things will last, like a 20 amp hour battery will last for 20 hours, then you can think about if your house was incredibly efficient just by using that energy in a completely different fashion, then these batteries would work for weeks, if not months, potentially even years on one single charge. I'm serious. And so, you know, you got to understand that these houses that we got right now, the way that we run our appliances, are so incredibly inefficient. If they're getting hot, you're using that power wrong. It's plain and simple. That means that energy is meeting resistance, and that's causing that extra heat going on. And there's things about, you know, eddy currents and stuff like that, you know, where this doggone metal in these transformers is actually trying to conduct electricity. They're trying to find a way for that place for that energy to go. All those coils need, whether it be the primary to the secondary or vice versa, is the doggone change in polarity in order to get the electron flow. You don't need to be cramming all that energy to it, and when you do that, you're not getting more power out of that thing. Look, science says energy can neither be created nor destroyed. So where does it go? It's there. But the thing about it is, and they're also trying to say that you can never get out more power than you put in, which might very well be the case, but nonetheless, you don't need the amount of power that you're putting in order to run that device. People have been tuning electric motors using capacitors for years, and that's because, you know, they thought that it had something to do with the frequency range. But what it did have to do with was the fact that all that excess power needed a place to go, because it was trying to run itself in one direction and run itself back in the other direction. It was the lens effect. It was when you put that energy in and it's coming back into the same generator you're trying to run the thing off of, it's creating a second field which is acting as a brake. And the more load you put on that thing, the harder that brake grabs down on that armature and slows it down yet even more, so it becomes less efficient. So two tungsten element light bulbs on your standard generator will bog that thing down. Three will bog it down even more, and so on down the line. Because of the way you're using that energy, you're allowing it to go come in out of the generator, and then you're allowing it to go right back into the same generator you're trying to pull the power from. And it's fighting itself. You know, that's what John Bedini was trying to tell everybody. But, you know, how people, you know, they always want to criticize. They don't want to listen. They don't want to think outside the box. He told them, you're all killing the dipole, you know. we're counterproductive to the energy that we want to use. And so let's keep going with this right here.
Power walls to go with your solar panel roof. Depending on where you live, your power consumption can vary widely, but the average U.S. home in 2011 used 940 kilowatt hours per month. A solar setup of that size would cost over $11,000, not including installation or taking tax credits into account. Then you'd need 5 power walls to store all of that sunshine juice, so that's another 15 grand. It's an expensive prospect right now, but as the cost of batteries and solar panels continue to drop, individual homes that are independently powered could become a great way to kick our fossil fuel habit. Inexpensive home batteries are looking like a promising innovation. They're not the only company innovating. Intel creates breakthrough technologies that make amazing experiences possible. Having Intel inside makes for better experiences outside. Intel drives innovation with products like processors, wearables, and IoT devices, and within data centers, in the PC, and beyond. Going green sounds like a lot of effort. Is it really worth it? Trace explains why, yes, totally, it is, right here.
Once you build a solar array and fields of wind turbines, those renewable energy sources start to cannibalize the power generation needs of the traditional power plants.
Would you use the Powerwall? Would it be like a supplement for your energy use, or would you go all out and be energy independent? Let us know in the comments, subscribe, and I'll see you next time on D News.
All right, so what do you learn in that whole deal? Batteries are expensive. That's what most people would have got from that whole deal. But what I'm trying to tell everybody is one of those power packs, and even to the extent one of the doggone wind turbines, those wind turbines and the doggone solar panels, They are capable of doing a whole lot more. You don't need near the solar panels to run this. Think about what I said earlier about a 20 amp hour battery. Okay, so you're drawing 20 amps out of this battery per hour. You're drawing 11.25 volts of 11.25 amps of power out of this battery. You have 20 hours of this until that battery finally gets down to where it's running itself down or whatever. So how many circuits do you know would run on 11.25 amps that had the capability of literally pulsing transformers and pushing out power out the other side? Think about that for a second. When you run an inverter, when you actually take a power inverter and you run an inverter, you can run AC appliances off of DC. And if you understand the amp hour equation right there, you can literally run. I'll play this next one. I'm going to skip over. It's another documentary on welding, but I'm going to go ahead and play this one right here because this guy explains how to take a 750 watt inverter and run your refrigerator for 1 hour. 1 hour on, 1 hour off. So you're going to run your refrigerator for 1 hour. You're going to let the sun or whatever charge that battery up for an hour, and then you're going to run it for another hour and so on down the line. Which, so worst case scenario, you know that you could at least run your refrigerator, just kind of minor modifications such as changing just the little light bulb inside there, the tungsten element light bulb. So you put an LED light system in there, or maybe just take the light out. You don't need the light inside there. You could use a flashlight if you had to, or daylight. But you could take that light bulb completely out of the equation and probably get it to run just a little bit longer because you're not draining that many watts off of this thing. So let's play this one right here.
Hey guys, Kip K here, and as many of you know, we had a major hurricane come through Florida about a week ago, Hurricane Irma, and it definitely affected just about everyone in Florida, including yours truly. We actually had to evacuate to higher ground, and fortunately, everything was pretty much okay. We had a little minor damage here at the home front, but you know, there was like 6 million people without power in Florida, and there was about 600,000 without power right here in Pinellas County where I live. That can create all kinds of problems, and a big issue is not having power, not being able to power your refrigerator. Well, I'm going to show you a really cool hack where you can power your refrigerator with a 12-volt battery. I'm going to take you over to my buddy Henrik's house. He is the crazy mad scientist. Let's check it out.
All right, before he gets into that, I want to say, imagine you got a 120-volt AC compressor inside of that refrigerator. All right, so you need 120 volts AC. So you're going to take that 12-volt battery and you're going to run an inverter to run this doggone this compressor. But what if that compressor was designed to run off of less, such as 12 volts or even 6 volts for that matter? If you take a look at some of the old technology, such as a 6-volt starters on a tractor, a starter motor generator kind of thing like that, and then suddenly you start having a few more aha moments going on. See, these things are specifically designed to run off of 120 volts AC, but that's not to say that they can't be designed to run off of less right straight out of the factory. The difference between appliances here in the United States and appliances overseas, we're at 60 hertz and they're at 50 hertz. We're at 120 volts. They might be at 220 volts. And for some reason, their appliances seem to last longer than ours over here. So, that's another one of the little secrets in the details, if you pay attention to, about how you're actually using energy. So let's keep going with this.
So
So what better is a sign of a mad scientist than a lot of clutter? He's got an awesome computer station, but down this hallway is where all the magic happens. Now, while it may look like a complete mess to you, it's not. You ask him for a 47-ohm resistor, and he'll find it in a second. So let's get to this hack. First off, we're going to unplug the refrigerator. You can see it's completely off here. And the first crucial step is to change the light bulbs in the refrigerator. That's right, they usually have incandescent bulbs, which use a lot more wattage than these LED bulbs, which is what we're going to use to replace the light in the fridge and the freezer. So that'll drop us down from 100 watts total to only 12 watts, which will help us in this project. Now to the battery. We're going to be using a standard 18 amp hour 12 volt battery. This is a smaller battery. It comes out of a jet ski, and it's more practical if you're going to have it inside your house than a car battery, which you can also use for this project. And the main component that's going to make this all happen is this 750 watt power inverter. Now this takes 12 volts DC and converts it into 110 to 125 AC, the US standard. Now while it's 750 watts, it's 1500 watts peak, which is going to be helpful for this project to work. And it has a set of jumper cables that'll attach to our 12 volt battery. Now, as a comparison, here is another power inverter. It's the same size, but it's only 500 watts, and it's not going to do the job. So you want to be sure you have a minimum of a 750 watt power inverter. Now, to measure what's going on, we're going to use a kilowatt, which will measure amperage and wattage through this setup. So we'll go ahead and plug that into one of the ports in the inverter, and then we're going to attach this small LED meter, which will measure the voltage on the battery. Now, as we fire up the inverter, you'll see it's outputting about 120 volts, and you can also see the voltage here on that 12-volt battery. Okay, so we moved everything over closer towards the refrigerator for this setup, and now we're ready to give it a shot. All right, here's the power cord for the refrigerator, and we're going to plug it into the kilowatt, and you'll see as soon as we plug it in, the lights come on in the refrigerator. Our refrigerator is now powered up with a 12-volt battery. It's drawing about 220 watts and about 2 amps. So this system will power a refrigerator for about an hour, and then you need an hour off to charge the battery. And it takes about 4 hours.
Pause. All right, now you heard he said it's drawing about 2 amps. Now you remember going back in the deal where we talked about a 20 amp hour battery is capable of putting out 11.25 amps for 20 hours. How you think about that? The secrets are in the details, folks. I keep trying to say this. I can't stress it enough. The secrets are in the details. If you've got access to 11.25 amps for 20 hours, then the way that this inverter is working right now will only give you an hour of runtime on that specific battery there. But if you have access to 20 hours of 11.25 and it's only taking 2 amps off of that, do the math. It'll make more sense. The way that these inverters are designed aren't necessarily efficient. Let's just keep going here for a second.
For food to go bad in a dead refrigerator. So if you do an hour on and an hour off, you could easily save everything in your refrigerator and power your fridge enough in an emergency. So that's how to power your refrigerator with a battery. Thanks for watching. We'll see you next time.
Alright, and that's one battery. That's just one battery. When you talk about a battery bank, the more batteries you got there, the more energy you have stored in there, and the more time that you'll actually have to run this thing. So what the other guy was talking about, how could you run your entire house off of a battery bank? Yeah, of course you can. There's people that are actually doing it, people that are off the grid using solar panels. But even their systems are so incredibly inefficient because of the way that they actually draw that power, the way they use them inverters. You can use an inverter wrong and not even realize you're doing it. You might be wired up exactly how the book says that you got to wire this thing. Everything's down to where it's supposed to be, but because of the way you're pulling that power off of those batteries, it's not going to last near as long. Now he said you could run that refrigerator for 1 hour. He said that refrigerator was only drawing 2 amps. Why is it only able to draw 2 amps for 1 hour when if you have a 20 amp hour battery that is capable of producing 11.25 per hour, why wouldn't that 2 amp draw last a lot longer? You see what I'm saying? So when you're using that energy off of that battery in that inverter, because that battery's trying to, you know, balance itself out, basically go down to where it was before you charged it, if you give it a pass, if it meets any kind of resistance, there's things that happen, you know, like you start to get heat. If you note that inverters have to have cooling inside of them. A lot of the inverters will have a fan inside there. So that fan is also drawing power as well. That heat and that resistance is also causing that battery, because the energy is trying to get around the other side. If it finds a path through it, it's going to do it. And it's going to generate heat, which is wasting energy. And it's making that battery have to work harder. It's making that inverter have to work harder. But imagine if you got a buffer between that battery and that inverter, such as a large capacitor bank. Now something different is happening here. You don't have that same issue that you had before, because that energy has a place to go. If you got a large enough capacitor bank, there is no way that that battery is going to fill that thing up completely. So you got an excess place, an extra place for that energy to be able to come back out of that inverter, because that's what's happening. That's why it's getting hot. When that energy is actually trying to travel back to that battery, because it can't use all of what all of what that battery has to offer, then that means that that inverter has built-in safety systems, such as a fuse that would break the circuit if it got too hot, and it would also have a fan to cool it down. If you can't keep it cooled down, some of them actually have a thermal switch in there that will actually shut that inverter off. And when the battery gets too low, it will detect the low portion of the battery and also switch the inverter off. It has an alarm system that tells you when the battery is getting low, and so it will actually shut itself off at a certain point. But imagine if that battery and the buffer in between there and that inverter is allowing that energy to flow freely and be able to have a place to go, as opposed to trying to fight itself. The battery is fighting with the inverter. It's making it where that battery is not going to last near as long. Your battery is going to get hot. Your wiring is going to get hot. The inverter is going to get hot, because you're trying to push too much current to a device that doesn't require near the amount of power to run it. If you think about what I'm saying, those transistors and power MOSFETs inside there, what they're doing is they're switching off and on that DC current. And as they're switching off and on that DC current, they're pulsing step-down transformers. It's taking it from 120 volts AC, basically ramping it up from 12 volts DC to 120 volts AC. Which basically is the equivalence of pulse DC when you actually think about the mechanics of the deal. But nonetheless, once it goes through that transformer, now you're back to AC current again, because those transformers don't care where all they're looking for is a change in polarity. Whether you're spinning magnets past a coil of wire, or whether you're putting a current to that coil of wire, when you induce a current in there, it produces a magnetic field. That magnetic field expands, it saturates the core, gets around to the other side, and that change in polarity gets the electron flow on the opposite side, on your secondary, whatever your secondary is going to be at that point. But nonetheless, even in that transformer itself is trying to ship power back in the opposite direction. Once you expand that magnetic field, and you induce the current in that primary coil, as soon as that field collapses, that energy is wanting to go back the other direction. It needs a place to go. They call that back EMF. A lot of people are trying to figure out how to take that back EMF and use it to run other things. Some people have figured it out. You have magnetic ballasts that don't have a secondary in them. It's just the primary. When you put the AC current to the magnetic ballast, it relies on that back EMF to actually energize those fluorescent bulbs. So, it's already been done. But if you understand all this step by step, how this stuff is going, those batteries are capable of doing so much more than what they do. And they're capable of, basically running for longer periods of time. It's all about how you're actually pulling this power off these batteries. And the battery technology is getting powerful. It's getting more efficient. If you think about like the electric power tools, the cordless skill saw, the cordless drill, the cordless sawzall, the cordless table saw, the cordless flashlight, the cordless, they got cordless everything nowadays. Cordless drill press, And so it's amazing how long you can actually run these things for, and you're actually using these things that they got gear ratios in there that are able to add a lot of torque to it, or if you want to add a lot of speed to it, whichever direction you turn the deal, speed it up or for more RPMs, or change gears and go for more torque. But either way, these things will last for quite a long time before they have to be recharged. And then you got a second battery's already on the charger, ready to just unsnap the one and snap it back in. So that's pretty doggone impressive. But imagine if that system was set up in a different way, to where that it's not using that power the same way that it was before. Those batteries, regardless of what style of batteries they are, whether it be nickel metal hydride, lithium, nickel cadmium, alkaline batteries, or lead acid batteries, it doesn't matter which kind of battery you're talking about. All of them, when they're trying to balance themselves out and that energy needs a place to go, it's the energy that's the key right there. What is the problem here? When you're putting this deal, if it meets any kind of resistance, that energy's trying to get through there. It has a lot of current. It's trying to get through this short little tiny wire. So that obviously that little tiny wire is going to get hot. Whatever that device can't use, that energy's trying to go back the other direction. And in the process of that, it's, making things get hot. Well, increase the surface area for those electrons to flow, then that means that more electrons can get back to the same generator that you're trying to pull the power off of. And that secondary magnetic field that is induced, the lens effect that is actually producing a second field that's trying to counteract the first field. It's acting like a brake. And once that happens, the more lights you turn on, the more electrons can get back there, the harder this effect, and eventually you turn too much stuff on and your generator will drop on its face because you just basically slammed on the brakes. But if you had a place for that energy to go instead of back to that generator, you can pull that power off of that generator and never have that generator bogged down. Gerard Morin, he's out there on YouTube. He's getting pretty frustrated these days, but he tried to show people, you take a 2,500-watt generator and you run it into a 50 kV transformer, and then that 50 kV transformer you run down to a 25 kV transformer. Well, what's going on there? Why was that generator able to charge that doggone tank up and then be able to keep power in that second tank and run more devices off of that second transformer, the smaller transformer, more than what that generator was rated for, more than the peak of that generator? It's because he understood that whenever he pushed the power to that transformer, he was using the first transformer as a storage tank. And he's using the second transformer to run the actual load. So you didn't have all that power trying to feed back into that generator. So that generator never seen the extra load. So the only portion of this system was the smaller transformer was actually carrying the load. It was actually doing the work. So it's between that smaller transformer and all the different devices that he was running off of that one deal right there. But the generator still had plenty of place to send that energy. That 50 kV transformer was never getting full. It was constantly, the power being drawn off by the 25, and so you could never fill that up. When you talk about voltage, voltage is pressure. Voltage is what actually gets work done. And so if you understand what I'm trying to say here, you didn't lose none of that energy. You're not getting out more than you put in. But what you're doing is you're not overpressurizing that container. It's just like blowing up a balloon. You blow that balloon up, you can only put so much pressure in it. Something's got to give. Well, if it's either the balloon pops or the pressure starts to force its way back and you meet an equilibrium where both sides are equal pressure and nothing else happens from that point on. You stop it dead in its tracks. That's why the generator drops on its face when we're running it the way that we're doing. You're pushing so much pressure to it, it's trying to push that pressure back in the opposite direction, and that generator just can't overcome that resistance. And so if you give that that pressure a place to go, a large storage bank, whether it be air pressure, water pressure, or electrical pressure, it doesn't matter. You give it a large place to go, there's enough power in there. And so when the smaller container is completely full, it will never go any less than completely full as long as there's some power available in that larger tank. If you think about what I'm saying is, you get three buckets. You put a large amount of water in the first bucket. You put no water in the second bucket. No water in the third bucket. And then watch as these buckets all fill up. And you stop the water at the other end so it can't go anywhere. Well, you got the little buckets full. The second larger buckets full. And the largest bucket is less full because you've already taken some of that pressure, that water out of, or whatever it is you got, out of the one tank into the next smaller tank and so on down the line. When you start drawing power on the first one and power on the second one, those two will stay constant. Now, the larger bucket, it has still has fluid in it. So as long as it's got it in there, it's going to keep the other ones topped off. And from that point on, all you got to do is keep putting a little bit at a time in the larger one. And as long as that larger one never goes completely dry, all the other ones underneath it are completely full. You're running your loads off the ones underneath the big one. I showed an example of this in my video 9 volt, where I was sitting there trying to explain to people, you know, all I had to do, turn this little hand crank generator a little bit, charge the thing up, put the hand crank generator down, walk around, talk for a bit, and then if I didn't want to do the actual hand cranking, I'd plug in the AC outlet. I charge it up again, unplug it, throw it on the table, walk around, talk for a little while. And so I wasn't having to constantly put energy into this system because of the way that this system was designed. All the smaller capacitor banks underneath there were running their prospective loads without having to have a constant power source to them. And from that point, all I had to do is keep a little bit of energy in that larger tank. I didn't have to constantly run my generator. I didn't have to constantly crank it. I didn't have to constantly work at it. All I had to do was make sure that that larger tank never went dry. And as long as the larger tank never goes dry, well, then all the other loads down underneath there are running constant. And if you understand that concept, about how this energy traveled, that you're pushing out 120 volts at 60 hertz out of that wall, that computer can't use that much. So why not allow whatever's trying to be shipped back out of that computer to go on down to the next load down there? We've got multiple outlets down there, and to some extent you get some of this. benefit from having two things plugged into one outlet. The transformer in this one, whenever its magnetic field is expanding, is pushing the motor on that one, and then whenever the magnetic field collapses, some of that energy goes back down the wire and pushes its way back down the line. But nonetheless, the way that we're running these, neither one of these two appliances can use that much energy, so it's got to have some place to go. So eventually, back and forth, it meets that resistance, is fighting itself to run, and so these doggone appliances eventually will start getting hot. Heck, you can heat your room with a computer because of the waste energy that's on this doggone thing. So with that said, what are we doing wrong? It's the fact that we're not understanding what's happening there. We're not trying to get out more power than we're putting in. We're not trying to defy any of the known laws of physics. What we're trying to do is figure out the most efficient way in order to run things so that we're not using so much power. And once you get that accomplished, there's your free energy, folks. Because if you ain't having to pay a doggone electric bill, or even if you do have to pay an electric bill, it's so insignificant of an amount, you're not overworking anything, and your appliances are lasting longer. And if the man gets on your nerves and you want to get completely off the doggone power grid, and you understand what it is that I'm saying, well, you can take that one solar panel or that one windmill, and you can get enough power to run your entire house throughout the entire day. Whether it's windy outside or not windy outside. If you take the same exact concept and you're pulsing this battery, using this battery as a pulse, to pulse a coil or a circuit board that's pulsing the coil or transformer, whatever. You take the same exact concept, stage by step, put a buffer in between every single load, and you give that energy a place to go, it will last a whole lot longer than it did prior. It'll blow your doors off. But nonetheless, all of this technology is already available. It's about putting the pieces of the puzzle. Once I get my doggone new lab together, I am excited about it. I'm impatient because I want to be doing it now. I love doing the Mad Science Show. I love doing this, talking to people and trying to share this information with people. You know, I'm not trying to get famous. I'm not trying to get wealthy. I'm not trying to scam anybody. I'm not trying to sell you anything. What I'm trying to do is help you out. The world said we had a problem. All right. Well, okay. We got a problem. Let's fix it. We got the knowledge to do so. So what are we waiting on? You know, it's mind-blowing. I want to go back to this last one right here. This is talking about welding as well. So, this is 1940s.
Your life work. If a lump of calcium carbide is dropped into water, bubbles of gas will rise. If this gas is ignited with a match, it will burn. The gas is acetylene, and when mixed with oxygen in the proper proportion, it produces the intensely hot blue oxyacetylene flame used in welding. The equipment necessary for oxyacetylene welding consists of a cylinder of oxygen, an oxygen regulator, a cylinder of acetylene, an acetylene regulator, lengths of oxygen and acetylene hose, and a welding torch. Mounted on a hand truck, such an outfit is readily portable and can be taken to the work no matter where it may be located. For large-scale welding operations, the equipment is somewhat more elaborate. Oxygen and acetylene may be piped throughout the shop or plant from a central point. In all welding, suitable clothing must be worn to protect the welder. For oxyacetylene welding, goggles must be used with lenses of special colored optical glass which protect the eyes from the bright flame and the intense glare of the molten metal. The welding torch mixes the oxygen and acetylene together in correct proportions. Separate valves regulate the volume of oxygen and acetylene. In lighting the torch, the acetylene valve is first opened slightly, and the friction lighter, which strikes a spark, is used. The oxygen valve is then opened, and the mixture of oxygen and acetylene adjusted. Because the temperature of the flame can be varied to suit the type of work, the oxyacetylene welding process is a very valuable one. The pieces of metal to be welded together must be prepared properly so they are free of any foreign matter. They are held in position with due allowance for shrinkage. When the flame is passed over the edges, the metal is quickly heated to a plastic stage. The welding operator uses a welding rod of metal similar to that being welded. The metal from the rod is melted into the joint, thus fusing the parts into one solid piece. The easiest welding position is where the work can be laid out flat. However, when overhead or vertical welds are made, the temperature of the metal must be controlled very carefully, or if it is too high, the weld may sag or drop out. The first-class welding operator must be able to weld work in any position, and he must be able to weld all materials. Many various metals can be welded, and welding is not only a trade in itself, but a part of nearly all occupations in which metal is used, including sheet metal work, boiler making, and steam fitting. The welder often uses oxyacetylene flame for cutting iron and steel, employing a cutting torch. This is similar to the regular torch, but it has an extra valve, operated by the thumb or finger, which controls a stream of pure oxygen.
There's a dead spot in there.
The metal is brought to a red heat at the point where the cut is to start. The cutting oxygen valve is then opened. The stream of pure oxygen combines chemically with the hot metal and burns it away along whatever pattern the torch follows. This process may be used to cut very thick metal. It may also be used to cut metal underwater.
Okay, pause this for a second. And so, he's cutting with a torch, an oxygen torch, oxygen acetylene torch. And if you look at the way that that doggone thing is cutting, it's leaving a rough cut. Anybody who's ever been around a welding shop where they're cutting with a torch sees it's got a rough cut. We have technology now with plasma cutters that will make a nice smooth cut every single time. And it's all using these same exact concepts. So let's keep going here. This is important stuff. Like I said, the secrets are in the details.
Spot welding is one example of the type of electric welding known as resistance welding. One of its important uses is that of joining sheet metal together. The spot welder is a machine with two copper electrodes. The sheet metal to be welded is placed between the points of the electrodes, and the current is turned on. The resistance of the sheet metal to the electric current, which passes between the electrodes, causes it to heat quickly to the fusion point.
Pause. So you're taking electricity, and because of the resistance, you have enough power to literally heat that metal to fuse it together. So you think about that in your transformers. You think about what the material of the coils of wire are, is like this, kind of epoxy coating resin that's on the top of the, it's an insulator between each of the turns of wires. You know, bare wire without no insulation, it might as well just be one wire when they're wrapped around and they're touching each other. You could take that same wire and you could make sure that none of these coils ever touched each other, and you wouldn't even need any type of insulator on this wire because they're not touching each other, but the magnetic field will work differently because they're not so closely together that magnetic field isn't going to be as near as strong. So once you understand what's going on, you know, that insulation in between there, it keeps that everything from shorting out. But without that, you get that resistance, because it's essentially a dead short, and that's what they're using with this spot welder, is a dead short, because it's resistance of that electrical, that current flow, that it's welding these two pieces of metal together.
And pressure on the electrode squeezes the metal together. Other types of resistance welding are similar in nature. In arc welding, the material to be welded is grounded to the generator, either directly or through a metal table on which the work is placed. The electric current is transmitted to the rod holder through a heavy cable. Touching the rod to the work completes the circuit and causes a spark, or arc. The intense heat of the arc melts both the metal and the welding rod, causing them to fuse together. In shielded arc welding, the welding rod is coated with a special substance which forms a gas. The gas shields the molten metal from the oxygen and nitrogen in the atmosphere, thus preventing impurities from forming. A weld of high quality is the result. When it is unnecessary to add metal to the joint, only the metal being welded is melted, and a carbon rod or electrode, which does not melt, is used. The mask worn by electric welding operators protects the face as well as the eyes. The electric arc gives off ultraviolet rays, so there must be no bare skin exposed, and clothing must be worn which will protect the operator from burns. Proper ventilation is necessary for all indoor welding.
Pause that for a second. Once again, you heard the reason why you got to cover yourself up, because in that process, you're releasing a lot of energy. There's plasma going on there. You got UV rays that can give you a sunburn while you're welding. It's funny, but it ain't funny, but if you go back and look at some of the older welder guys or gals or whatever, and they use them little round goggles when they get done welding, and they take those goggles off, it looks like they've been out in the sun with sunglasses on, because their face is red and their eyes are still the normal color. They don't have a sun tan, if you understand what I'm trying to say here. But that is just a key point in the fact that there's more energy there than you actually need to do the job. That extra excess energy is coming in the form of light. Ultraviolet light. It's energy, wasted energy in that process of actually doing the welding. So imagine how much power that a welder is actually capable of. Imagine what that excess energy could actually do. So if you think about what I'm saying right here, it starts to turn on some light bulbs. It starts to turn on some aha moments, plasma technology, or even to the extent of being able to run a turbine, whether it be coal fire power plant or whatever, something to turn a doggone generator head to produce electricity, and what you do with that electricity after that differently than you do in the standard model that we're doing right now, you can get that electricity to do a heck of a lot more work. A lot more. A whole lot more work. And this is the key. This is the key to what I'm trying to get across here. It's not that we don't have enough energy. It's that we're not using it properly. If you're generating heat, then that means you're doing something wrong with that energy. There should be a point where any excess energy that would have gotten wasted otherwise would got recaptured and reused. There's so many different things. I mean, we're not even scratching the surface. But you've heard about, where you're taking oxygen and acetylene and, you're actually cutting through steel with that right there. All right? And as far as whether we're going to use the, internal combustion engine to run a generator or whatever, even back to that point, you can get those internal combustion engines to run so incredibly efficient that you're barely using any doggone fuel. These modern day engines are really impressive in their engineering, their technology, but the problem is they're still incredibly inefficient. Your average internal combustion engine's only using about 30% of that fuel. The rest of it is getting shipped down the exhaust pipe. Some of which, because of the way the catalytic converter works in order to clean the emissions up, helps to suck some of that back up air and back into the intake. But it's happening so fast and there's so much pressure involved that a lot of it's escaping out the exhaust pipe anyway. So the majority of all the fuel that you put in your engine is going on down the road. So if you understand that concept, and you start re-engineering a few things to work differently, the harder you press down on that gas pedal, the less fuel that you should be using. And because you're actually shortening the time that actually has to burn that fuel. And you're still going to get the same amount of power. The reason why we got to have all these fancy things on our fuel injection system, basically a O2 sensor and all that kind of stuff, because the faster you get to running, that fuel's not working and burning efficiently, so you got to shove more oxygen down inside there in order to be able to compensate for that shorter time that it would actually have to burn in order to give you a stronger boost and get you on down the road. Some of the race car people out there figured out that if you take and put on a turbo that you can actually, you know, put more pressure inside there, and that's basically shoving more air down into that that intake system down there so that you get a better burn out of the deal, burning more fuel, getting a stronger push down the road. But even to that extent, they haven't took it far enough. These engines should be so incredibly efficient that you're hardly using any fuel, even if you're out there racing with the stuff. It's like I said, it's not that we don't have enough energy, we're just not using it properly. It doesn't matter whether we're talking about air pressure, water pressure, or electrical pressure, it's all doing the same exact thing. And if you're not using it and you're not allowing for that that excess pressure to find a place to go, besides, you know, out into the atmosphere, well, then you got the same exact problem. You know, you can have 60 PSI in a big old giant tank, and there's still room for more inside there. And that 60 PSI is enough to run your standard air tool or whatever. You know, pneumatic tools. The pneumatic engines that they're actually out there working on right now, engines that run off of air power. You know, there's ways that we can generate enough air power to keep those things running on down the road, using electricity or even temperature and stuff like that. You know, you heat up a container that's sealed, it's going to pressurize that atmosphere inside there. So all of these little deals right here are something worthy to take note of so that you can make more efficient machines. When it comes down to electricity, sometimes looking at something like a welder will open up your eyes to see, hey, wait a second, what's going on here? You know, you're taking 120 volts AC and you're pulsing a couple microwave oven transformers and you're melting steel with it. That's pretty impressive. So what else could you do with it? If you understand what the amount of power that's actually in a battery, one of those batteries is more powerful than you think it is. Just because the way that we run it, people don't believe that it's possible. Because the way that we're running it is causing it, we're like at the 20 amp hour battery is capable of putting out 11.25 amps per hour for 20 hours solid, and you're pulling more amperage off of that, then it's going to shorten that time. Well, even at 11.25, it's still making everything work too hard. And if we could just get past that one concept right there, and people started engineering their electrical devices differently, or even if it's a standard device that is, you don't even have to change anything with exception of putting a buffer between that appliance, so that appliance has a place for that excess energy to be able to escape. that excess energy is going to take the path of least resistance. It's that computer cannot, and I repeat, it cannot use the amount of power that you're pushing to it. That electric fan cannot use the amount of power you're pushing to it. The doggone compressors in our refrigerators, our freezers, our air conditioners cannot use the amount of power that you're pushing to it. And so whatever isn't able to be used by that system is trying to go back the other way. But since there's no place for it to go, it's bouncing back and forth in there. You got more power coming in. You got power trying to come back the opposite direction. These two powers are colliding with each other. They're meeting resistance. They're causing friction, which in turn is causing heat, total chaos in that wire. Your wiring's getting hot. Your outlet's getting hot. Your compressor's getting hot. And eventually something reaches its thermal breakdown. And hopefully for your benefit that it's the circuit breaker that finally reaches its thermal limit and shuts itself off before burning down your house. It's so ridiculously simple, folks. So ridiculously simple. And I'm impatient. I'm getting excited because I want to get my new lab together, because the moment I get that thing together, I'm going to start showing you all these concepts in practice, real time, where you can not only know what's going on, you know it works, you understand it completely, you don't have to be a rocket scientist or an electrical engineer or electronics wizard or any of that, any of the high-tech names for all these people out there with talent, you know, a little bit of education, but you'll understand what's going on. It's that ridiculously simple. And, you know, all these folks out here, hey, credit to them, they went to college, they learned all this stuff, but they still weren't able to look outside the box. They didn't understand what was going on in how this energy is moving around. They know you need to put so many watts to this right here, and sure, the math says, and this and that. Well, what's wrong with this system? What's wrong is you're generating a lot of heat. And heat is a byproduct of using energy. So where's that heat going? We got to plug another device into it to disperse that heat. We got to have a heat sink on it. And when that heat sink won't do it by itself, the fan kicks on. You look at your doggone engine in your car, folks. You're starting at 160 to 180 to 220 degrees Fahrenheit, depending on what type of engine you got and how hard you're running it. When that water temperature, when it first gets started and the water's cold, you'll have a little bitty thermal valve inside there called a thermostat. It'll hold that water into the engine block until that engine gets warmed up, until it gets the oil all, you know, warmed up to, you know, get everything going and everything. When it finally reaches its final temperature, that thermostat will actually open up, allowing that water to circulate out of the block into your radiator. And then from that point on, your radiator has a thermostat on it as well, a thermal switch that when it reaches a certain temperature, it opens up the switch and turns on the fan and cools down your radiator so that you can maintain a specific temperature in that engine. Anything above that normal operating temperature, then other things in that engine will start to reach its thermal breakdown and will begin to fail. If none of these things can ever reach their thermal breakdown point, they will never fail. And if you understand how that energy is in that car, the only place that you need that heat energy is in that cylinder. You don't need it anywhere else. So why do we have engines that if you run for an hour or so and you go up there and you put your hand on that engine, you'll burn a blister the size of Texas on your hand? Because they are engineered improperly. They, they're pretty impressive. I mean, they do what they do. I mean, it's you put gas in it, you can drive really fast, you can get things here and there, or whatever. But they could run so much better with a little bit of re-engineering. If the only place in that engine that you need heat is inside that cylinder, then why are we heating up the entire engine? Why do we have to have a cooling system, a water jacket on this thing in order to cool this thing down in order so it doesn't seize itself up? You know, breaking down the viscosity of the oil and, you know, causing it to have to work harder. And then eventually when that oil gets too thin, and it starts to break down, and then the bearings are rubbing up against each other. Now you have a problem because they'll tear each other apart. That engine, if it wasn't for that radiator, if it wasn't for the cooling systems on that, it generates more power. If there was ever a case for over unity, then the internal combustion engine would be that. You measure out the wasted BTUs in an internal combustion engine of the modern day engine the way that they're engineered, and it would blow your doors off. You're wasting so much energy. And the way that things are designed, even all the way down to the rings, the split rings inside the piston that are actually helping that engine to keep compression, the way that those are designed, they allow for a tiny bit of carbon blow-by. Whatever fuel isn't burned inside there, some of that carbon gets down in through those doggone rings and down into that oil, and that's why you got to have an oil filter on there. Or when the things reach its thermal breakdown point and you get little shavings of metal because they're tearing each other apart because the oil ain't doing its job anymore, now those little oil parts also have to be filtered out. If you look inside of the oil pan of a lot of different cars these days, you'll find that there's a magnet down there that's supposed to catch any metal that comes by from something that's failed in the system. It'll suck that metal down there to the magnet and keep it from tearing up your engine and your bearings and all that kind of stuff. So, all of this, the way that we're using this energy, the way that we're using our fuel systems, all these things are inefficient because we're not understanding these basic concepts. It's simple science. It's simple physics. It's simple mechanics. Everything has a thermal breakdown point, including your electrical wire. Every appliance you got has a thermal breakdown point. The computer has a thermal breakdown point. All the transistors, all the MOSFETs, all the different IC chips and all that, they don't need near the amount of power you're pushing to them in order to be able to do the same exact job that they're doing right now. And if people out there would get this little concept, you would end up with devices that are so incredibly efficient. You look, some people out there know this. If you take that cell phone that you got, you charge it up and count how long that you can actually use that cell phone. I mean, getting on there, surfing the internet, getting on there, calling people up, and you just do different measurements of how many tasks that you can do in one day. Maybe just leave the cell phone on the table. Don't do nothing with it. Don't call it. Don't put it in range of the Wi-Fi system, and see how many days that battery will actually last doing what it's doing. Measure the temperature off of it, and you'll start to see something pretty impressive. When you're overworking that thing, it'll get warm. When you're charging it or whatever, it'll get warm. You'll notice different temperature differences. But what you will be able to come away with, hopefully, if you pay attention to detail, is the fact that that doggone thing is pretty impressive as far as the way that it uses that energy, and it ain't catching itself on fire. It's not reaching its thermal breakdown. It's not failing. Heck, they make these things so durable you can drop them on the floor, unless it's one of them big screen deals where you crack the face and you end up having to go buy you a new one because it's you can't use it anymore. But for the most part, these cell phones are nearly indestructible. You can drop them multiple times, and the way that they're designed to withstand that impact, they want them to be able to do that. I mean, if you want to spy on somebody, the best way to do it is make sure you got something that ain't going to break easy. You know, it's durable, it's waterproof, and so on down the line. So, all this stuff right here, it's not new. These folks out there, they know what I'm talking about. They know exactly what I'm talking about. And they know how to make things more efficiently. But if I want to sell you fuel, I don't want you to know you can run that on something that don't cost you nothing. If I want to sell you oil or diesel fuel or whatever, I don't want you to know that you can make it out of stuff you found in your doggone yard. No, I don't want you to know that. I don't want you to know how to refine it. I don't want you to know that because I want to sell you oil. I want to sell you electricity. I don't want you to know that you can be more efficient. And I had a doggone person from a power company. When I asked him, I said, how come I keep getting these notices saying that I'm using 75% more energy than all of my neighbors? And the first thing, words out of his mouth, he says, that's just propaganda. Everybody gets that. So they're sending the same doggone thing to everybody else, and everybody else is trying to figure out a way to become energy efficient because they're believing they're using 75% more energy than their neighbor. When in reality, they probably got a smaller bill than I got. I'm running more electric appliances than they are. I'm running more buildings than they are. You know, I know that I'm not using near the amount of power as the school that's up the street from me. And so if my bill comes home ridiculous, then I'll call the man up and say, you better sort this out, brother, because we ain't playing this game. I know I didn't use that much power. I didn't use more than the school that only had a 700, and you're trying to send me a $2,500 bill? Must have lost your mind. So yeah, I told the power company I'm gonna study everything that there is to know about alternative energy, and when I get that accomplished, I'm gonna share it with each and every one of their customers for free. And since I am a man of my word, I'm doing just that. That's what Mad Science is all about. They said we have a problem in the world. I'm here to help fix it. You know, your talents, your tools, my talents, my tools, all of our gifts combined, we got this. We got this. I'm going to finish this little deal out here.
In production work, the welding operator may work on only one kind of material, held in a jig or form, and with just one kind of welding equipment. The operator may become highly proficient in specialized work and still not qualify as a skilled welder in other types of work. Job welding calls for a greater variety of skills. One time the welder may use the oxyacetylene flame, and another time the electric arc. One job might be welding cast iron, and the next mild steel, and still another a different kind of steel or alloy. The job welder must therefore understand how to work with many materials in order to adjust his equipment correctly and select the right welding rod for each one. If you plan to be a welder, to be successful, you must have good eyesight, fine muscular coordination, and because much of the work is strenuous, you should be strong. In addition, a good knowledge of welding principles is necessary, along with practical blueprint reading and some mathematics. Electrical physics and some chemistry will be helpful. Many schools offer elementary shop courses in welding, both during the day and at night. There are many private welding schools. If you decide to attend one of them, investigate thoroughly and select a good one. Many machine parts which used to be cast as one piece are now welded from steel plates. This process provides greater strength with less weight and at lower cost. In the automotive industry, welding is employed in many ways. It has made possible strong steel automobile bodies, as well as the coaches and engine cabs of streamlined trains, lightweight and attractive in appearance. The stout tubular frameworks of airplanes are welded, as are countless other parts, from fuel tanks to landing gears. Such welding is carefully inspected, and if you choose welding as your life work, it will be worth your while to work hard to qualify yourself as an inspector. There are many welding jobs in shipyards. Large hull sections can be welded together in shops then hauled and hoisted to the ways and welded into a complete hull. Because no rivet holes are necessary, welding is stronger than riveting. Weight, which can be saved by using lighter plates and by eliminating rivets, increases the ship's carrying capacity. Members are welded in constructing large buildings, skyscrapers, bridges, and other engineering projects in place of riveting them. If you like outdoor work, this offers an interesting job in the welding field, as do many other types of job welding. Pipeline welding should also interest you. Welding crews travel across the country, welding lengths of pipe together. This work, too, is carefully inspected, and you will have to pass special welding tests before you can do pipeline welding, or weld any other high-pressure equipment, such as steam pipes or boilers. New applications of welding are continually being employed in many industries, and as a result, the welding field will probably continue to grow. For the welding operator who develops real skill, there are good opportunities.
Yeah. All right, so I hope that I didn't bore you to tears with all that. But there's a lot of energy involved in that. There's a lot of good knowledge when it comes down to how these actual welders actually work. You go back and you listen to some of the other podcasts and you hear about things about different transformers and how they work inside and all these different things. I've been putting all the pieces of the puzzle on the table for a long time. I've been trying to give you the aha moment, to turn the light on so that you can see that there's a lot more going on than meets the eye. It's not, like I said, it ain't a fact that we don't have enough energy. We never had an energy crisis. Everything is fuel. I did a video or a doggone radio show about that as well. Everything out there is fuel. And so, you know, it's about how are you going to work with nature? How are you going to take all this different knowledge and put it together in a system that is going to be beneficial to you? Imagine if you had an engine that would run on water, pure distilled water, no additives. And the only purpose for this engine was to generate electricity. Imagine, it starts raining outside. Well, some of that rainwater might get thrown into a system that is going to clean that rainwater up and use it for fuel in your engine. The wind's blowing outside, and so you're taking some of that energy from the wind power and you're storing it. You ain't even using it yet. You're just storing it, putting it in a bank. And you got the sun doing the same exact thing. You got processes out there going on all day long. If you live near a river, you got that energy as well. If you live near a volcano, you got some thermal vents. It's all kinds of possibilities. But nonetheless, if you go back and you look at that video series that I put together, Free Thinkers, that's the one a whole lot of people got it. You know, a whole lot of people didn't understand. But that thing ran for a long time. I finally shut it down many years after I started it. But that was because somebody cut a doggone wire on there, and the whole key was for me to do an experiment to see how long that thing would take care of itself. I didn't do any maintenance on it, outside of maybe sweeping some grass off of the solar panels whenever the doggone grass was mowed or something like that, sweeping some snow off, which you really don't have to do on the snow portion because some of that light will actually make it through that snow. But nonetheless, that thing ran for a long time, pulling energy from all different directions. And it's easily replicatable. You know, if you want to build you a free thinker style generating system to run power at your house, well, You take all the information that I put out there on the table, you take all the research that you've done, you find out, look, hey, this is a solar panel over here, I can get this much power out of that. I can move this power over here. I can move that power from that over this way right here. And heck, when the kid's on the swing set over there, he can put some more power in there because I'll modify that swing set to, you know, pick up some energy from that as well. So no matter what's going on, you know, people power, you know, hamster power, don't matter. You know, there's a lot going on in this world. And all of that energy is usable, all of it's storable, you know. And if you understand what I've been trying to say about, like, the internal combustion engine, well, you think about it for a second. If that engine is getting so hot that it has to have a radiator and a fan to cool it down so that it don't exceed its temperature, and we're talking about even in weather where it's, like, super, super hot outside, or even super, super cold for that matter, that engine can still overheat in the wintertime. But what if you took that same engine and its only purpose was to generate electricity as opposed to, you know, driving you to and fro work? So now you got this engine producing electricity, plus you have a heating system. So you just turn this generator into a dual purpose deal. It's producing electricity. It's heating your house up with using the water, just like the radiator heats your heater core inside your vehicle. And so you just made it more efficient. At that point in the game, that inefficiency now becomes a plus. Well, even to that extent, most of the fuel that you put inside there, because of the way that it's engineered, is going to go out the exhaust pipe. So why wouldn't you be able to take those exhaust gases and store those as well? Store that excess fuel that's coming out that exhaust, or maybe even pipe that exhaust into a secondary engine and run that engine as well. So now you're running two engines for the price of one off of the exhaust of another. Is it possible? Have you tried it? Anyway, so regardless, just by utilizing that engine in a completely different fashion, you're not wasting near the amount of energy that you was before. You repurposed it, you took that engine, instead of running your car down the road, now you're using this engine to actually generate electricity to run your house. And so the only problem you get from that point is the fuel cost. You know, how much would it cost you to run that engine sitting out there all day long running and, you know, then doing what it does, you know, eating up fuel or whatever. But you'd be surprised of how much more efficient it would be with a little bit of engineering on the way that you're actually introducing that fuel to the system to begin with. So there are solutions out there. If you had a diesel generator instead of a gasoline generator, well, you're even better off than the other guy, because now you can go around to all the different places that sell or try to figure out how to get rid of their waste oil, whether it be from food waste or actual, you know, automotive repair shops that are changing oil and, you know, they don't necessarily send it in for recycling. Which is ridiculous, because with a little piece of machinery in their shop, they can recover that oil and clean it out and make it where it's just as good as it was before. So they wouldn't be wasting it. And if it wasn't for all the regulations, they'd probably be able to resell it. But these are the things that if you understand about, then you see right now, you had a diesel generator, you can get heat from the waste energy of the generator while it's sitting there running your electricity. And if you got the proper storage bank and you're using that, it's not even having to work hard. You can ship some of that energy over to your neighbor and still have a surplus. But who am I to say? I'm just the guy sitting here trying to show everybody there's got to be a better way. There is definitely a better way. There are solutions available. If you're not willing to humor them, What am I to do about it? But I want to show with a few devices. I want to show the world how energy actually works. I'm going to show them some pretty amazing things about magnetic fields and frequencies that they might not have otherwise thought about. You don't need near the amount of power to get the work done, to live in the comforts that you're living right now that we're accustomed to. The system's designed the way the system is. It's inefficient. Everything's inefficient. Even the way that we go out and we farm, you know, we're out there farming, we're producing problems in the process of that farming, some of which that people don't even realize that they're producing. The runoff just from the farmer and all of his fertilizer is causing a hazard down the line. Nature starts to clean this thing up. But if you notice modern day farms these days, go around and check out your farms. And then go check out the neighboring ponds around these farms. These ponds are so highly nutrient rich because of all the different runoffs of all the different fertilizers that are being used that are basically being used excessively. They don't need near the amount of fertilizer that they're actually putting on. Most of this fertilizer ends up going down the stream, and when it pools up in a pond, then that means that pond is so super highly nutrient rich that duckweed and watermill will grow out of style. And if there is no duckweed or watermill, then the algae will grow out of style. Duckweed, watermill, algae can all be turned into biofuel. So if the farmer was smart, he would be recycling last year's fertilizer for next year's crop and then turn around and sell the byproduct, which would be the duckweed or watermill or the algae, as biodiesel to run his tractors. So it's a no-brainer. You protect the environment. You actually save yourself fuel cost. You make products that you can turn around and you can feed to the chickens. You can feed to people in worst case scenario. It just has to be cooked properly. But nonetheless, you're solving your own problem. You're solving problems down the line just by understanding how nature is actually functioning. By understanding how energy is actually working. You take that tractor and you turn it into a really super efficient machine. Any waste energy that would have been otherwise had isn't even a factor anymore. If the only place that you need heat energy is in that cylinder, then why is the whole entire engine getting hot? It's because you're not understanding what's going on. But if done properly, you could design that engine to where you could run that thing all day long as hard as you wanted to. It would never reach its thermal breakdown. It would never fail. You could put your hand right on the top of it after it had been running all day long, and you're not going to burn your hand. It's as simple as that. You know, that heat energy wants to travel. It's just like electricity. It'll travel. And, you know, it's energy. If the only place you need it is in the cylinder and it's all the way out there to the extent where it's got sweat rolling off the forehead of the tractor operator, then you're doing it wrong. Plain and simple. With electricity, with air pressure, with water pressure, with, all the different ways that we're using energy right now, we have a tiny little understanding of what's actually really occurring. Mad Science is here to try to explain that in such a simple fashion that maybe some of the big boys out there in industry will pay attention and start doing the right thing. I highly doubt it, though. They still want to sell you electricity. They still want to sell you fuel. And they're not going to give that up willingly. You got to keep the pockets full, if you understand what I'm saying. So, with all this knowledge that you're getting, you go out, you go look back in history, you look at the machinery, you do some research into documentaries, you check out a few things. You look at how them inverters actually work, you look how electric motors actually work. You think about voltage, you think about voltage being pressure, water pressure, air pressure, don't matter. It's all the same. All this energy works the same. You can even send it out in waves, you know, and those waves will actually cause other, you know, for every action is an equal and opposite reaction. You cause something to happen. But nonetheless, with that little bit of knowledge, you start to see where the problems are in the way that we're using things. The way that we're trying to pull power off of that battery. You know, that battery's got a lot of power. And it's trying to send its maximum amount of power through whatever size wire that you've got going in there. It's trying to send it into that deal. And it's trying to get around to the other side. It's trying to balance itself out. It's trying to take those two separate charges and balance them out. Which means your battery would be dry. It'd be empty. You know, that's what nature does. Puts it back to where it was when it started. It wasn't natural that this battery had a charge on it. And, you know, we figured out that we can mix this chemistry with these two types of metals and we can get a battery. You know? And we figured out that battery can do a lot of things. But the fact is, it can do a whole lot more than what you think it can. And if you go all the way back in history and you look at the mercury arc rectifier, it was a plasma reactor. It's capable of a whole lot more than you could possibly imagine. And until people's willing to step outside the box and actually look at it, you know, pay attention to it. How hot is plasma? Yeah, think about it. You know, what is the sun? You know, all that hydrogen that they say is causing the sun to, you know, do what it does. We got the power of the sun, and we can able to weld two pieces of steel together. We can melt it from rocks and turn it into steel. We got all this technology, and we still can't figure out something as simple as how energy actually functions. It's ridiculous. The scientists don't even know what gravity is. They call it magnet. They call it magic. We don't know what it is. So, you know, if they can't figure that one out, then I don't know what to tell them. But, you know, hey, it is what it is. The mainstream science folks, they got their education. And they were told what to think. And they won't go outside that realm. And if you try to communicate with them, and you don't use the proper language, the proper terminology, they won't even know what you're talking about. They'll think you're stupid. You don't know what you're talking about. You don't know what you're talking about. Back and forth. And nothing gets done. Absolutely nothing gets done. Well, I'm here to get things done. I'm here to try to get some people in this world who really want to seriously get things done, and let's get it done. Don't sit around complaining about what we can't do. Let's talk about what we can do. Let's talk about why these doggone appliances are tearing themselves up. Well, if you're in the industry, you want it to happen. It's called planned obsolescence. It's got to fail so you can sell them a new one. If you've got a light bulb that lasts forever, well, then you ain't going to sell light bulbs, are you? Think about it. It's that ridiculously simple. The whole thing is ludicrous. You know, stepping back and looking at the big picture, and when you finally see what's really going on, it'll knock your socks off. Because the sheer ignorance, and sometimes it's willful ignorance, of the way that the system is allowed to continuously keep on doing the same dang thing that it's been doing. And that people just can't step outside the box. Oh no, they said they won't take it. That's why somebody got so mad at me, because I said that I don't care about current watts and amps. I lost friends over that. Do you know that? I lost friends over that. You know, I tried to build a dream team. But because I told all these people I don't care about current watts and amps, they had a hissy fit. They didn't understand what I was trying to tell them. And since they didn't understand it, well, you can't do nothing without current watts and amps and all this kind of stuff. It just don't work like that. They didn't understand what I was doing. You could not take your standard voltmeter and read what it was that I was doing. because it wasn't at the right frequency range. I was specifically looking into plasma, how plasma actually functions, what the uses of plasma was for, and at those types of ranges, you know, outside of trying to make some sort of, you know, thing with an oscilloscope where you can pick up the radiant energy and try to do some really complex math to figure out exactly how much power was really there, you couldn't take your standard voltmeter and register it. You couldn't take an amp meter and register it. So the current watts and amps did not matter at that point in the game. Now, when I get around to turning that power back in there, because they say energy can neither be created nor can it be destroyed, so where does it go? All right, well, I figured that out. I know where it goes. And so, with that said, you know, they didn't have no reason to get mad. They just wanted to take that education that they got, and they wanted to either sound more intelligent or try to convince me that I didn't know what it was I was talking about. But what I was trying to explain to them all along is that the way that we're using energy is wrong. You can take this high voltage with no amperage whatsoever, and you can move it without any resistance across fast, really fast. And at that point in the game, you don't need amperage to do that. I lit up a tungsten element light bulb that was burnt out in the millivolt range using a 12 volt Beckett oil burner igniter. You get one of those, look at the specs on there, and you'll see the milliamp range on that thing. So it only took me that much power to light that bulb up that otherwise would have took a lot more power, where the watts would have mattered, running straight off your battery. That's where your measurements are going to work. They won't work if you change that energy to a completely different form of energy than the energy that we're using now. It's all the same energy, it's just either moving faster or it's moving slower. But you can't measure it at that point. You could measure the voltage to some extent. Could you get it down to the exact? You could measure from the input side. You could measure that. But when it gets into the middle stage right there where you've just changed it into plasma, your voltmeter don't work no more. But instead of waiting and hearing what I had to say, they got angry. And basically, I lost a lot of friends because I said that I didn't care about current watts and amps. I'm still saying it. And, you know, if I lose more friends, well, hey, so be it. You got your education. You know what you know. It works for your system, but for the system that is to come, it has no place. It's not the same. You know? So, hey, they told the Wright brothers they'd never fly, right? It's all right. Tesla tried to show everybody something, you know, and he wasn't treated very nicely about it. Well, I'm trying to revive some of that. I'm trying to give him the recognition that he deserved. He was a brilliant man. He made modern society what it is, as far as I'm concerned, technology-wise. You know, with all the different things that he put out there on the table, you can talk to me over a cell phone. You can talk to me over a computer. We can do it from long distance apart. We can do it clear around the globe. And all that stuff that he set out there for us, that paved the way. So if we're going to stagnate here in this realm and not move any farther, it's going to get to be a pretty boring world. But I want to boldly go where no man has gone before. I want to see how far we can actually go. And in order for us to get there, we got to become so incredibly efficient that it doesn't take near the amount of power to do the work that we need to get done. And I'm saying it right now. There is more power in a battery than you can possibly imagine. if you can see the power of the sun, literally the power of the sun in plasma, and you can see that weld or that plasma cutter cutting through steel, and you don't understand what's happening there, that's a lot of power. Used efficiently, we talked about a 20 amp hour battery being able to push out a 11.25 amps per hour for 20 hours solid. So if you got a circuit that runs on less than that, like the guy said, it was only pulling 2 amps to run the doggone refrigerator up a 750-watt inverter. Now, is he wrong? I don't know. Do the math. Try it out yourself. Do whatever. But if what he said was true, then that means that you're only drawing 2 when you have the capability of doing 11.25 per hour. So if 11.25 will last for 20 hours, how long would the 2 last? So if you got a circuit that will run off of 2 amps that is capable of pulsing a transformer that is capable of putting out 220 volts AC out the other side, and you take that 220 volts AC and you run it into a storage bank, just like what I'm doing with the doggone signal generator. I'm taking 5 volts, I'm running it through a DDS signal generator, I'm ramping it up to approximately 9 volts, and keep in mind, we're not talking about a lot of amperage or wattage or anything like that. All I'm doing is taking that 9-volt signal that's coming out of there, approximately 9 volts, give or take. 9-volt signal, pulsing a microwave oven transformer, taking that microwave oven transformer that is then in turn pulsing the secondary, running it through AC run capacitors, or AC start capacitors, because I want a big boost, and then I'm running that into a bridge rectifier, and then I'm out the bridge rectifier. Now that it's a DC signal, I'm charging up DC capacitors, and I'm going from them DC capacitors to modern day ultra capacitors or other boost capacitors, however you want to say it. They act more like a battery. And in this entire system, there is not one battery in this entire system runs all these circuits. Because I understand how that energy's traveled. The key about this whole entire deal is from the wall outlet, the only thing that is getting hot in that entire deal is the transformer that is actually a step-down transformer that you plug in that has a USB port pushing 5 volts out of it. So on the transformer side, connected to the wall, because that doesn't need near that much power, that will get warm. The rest of that is 5 volts out, and then all the way down, I'm ramping that up to over 100 volts on this system. And I'm running it. So, what's going on there? If you take that into consideration, and you look at everything that we've got going on, we're using energy improperly, and with my new lab, I aim to prove it. I said that I was going to study everything that there is to know about alternative energy. And when I got that accomplished, I was going to share it with each and every one of their customers for free, and I meant it. You can take that to the bank. Shaziz here ain't here to deceive. I'm not here to get famous. I'm not here to get rich. I'm not here for notoriety or any of that like that. They said there was a problem. I come to the front, I said, okay, let's fix it. I paid attention in science class, folks. I've been called everything under the sun. I've been told that I'm stupid. I've been said a lot. I've had a lot of filthy words slung my way because I was outside the box and I would not bend to their will. I refused to allow them to tell me that the school book was the only way. Somebody out there wrote them school books. And somebody out there formulated an education for you. They want you to be a good worker. They don't want you to be a good thinker. They'll let you think to some extent. But if you put yourself outside that box, you're going to have to reach the. You're going to have to realize you're going to get criticized. You're going to get criticized by your peers. All these mice in the maze trying to find a way out, and you're sitting on top of the deal saying, "Hey, look, it's as simple as just jumping this wall, and we're out of this mess." They will literally pull you back down in. They will criticize you and tell you how wrong you are for fear of their own safety. It's like what that guy said in the Matrix. There are people inside the Matrix that will fight with everything that they have to preserve the same system that is oppressive. When the world is ready, we can fix it. I want to see people out there that need food have food. I want to see people out there that need electricity, energy to keep them warm and cool when they need to be cooled. I want to see them have it. I want to see that for the entire world. I want to see everybody uplifted. I can't do it alone. But if you think that what I've been telling you is the right thing, you know, that's great. Share it. If you don't, test it. Try it. Test it out. Take all these podcasts that I keep pointing out to you. Download them in case something happens and you need this information. I mean, we're sitting here, like my friend Steve always said, we're sitting here with the vast sum of all man's knowledge at our fingertips. We're at a crossroads where we got an opportunity to do something so incredible, to see how far we can actually go as humanity. That's what mad science is all about. And I told the power company what I told them. I meant it. I'm here to do it. Keep the ball rolling. I'll keep on shouting as long as the mainstream science ain't getting their act together. You're going to sit out there and tell me all this stuff about how bad our world is. And all these years, they still haven't fixed nothing. What are they fixed? As a child, when I was seeing videos on the news of children starving in this world, I see pieces of machinery and technology capable of going clear across this world and back. Why is there somebody in this world that can't get some food? Why? Well, those are the kind of subjects we talk about on the Knights of the Round Table. So, if you just joining in here today, Mad Science is on Saturday. We're going to talk a lot about science. Maybe sometimes on the Knights of Roundtable we'll talk about science as well. But a lot of times we talk about problems in the world, and we talk about solutions. We talk about how to bring people together. We talk about everything that needs to be talked about. We share information. We share, our companionship, our friendship. We do it like a family. That's what we do. That's what People for People Radio Network does. That's what Shaziz Radio Network does. And that's what all them other networks out there do whenever they rebroadcast us. If you find a podcast out there and you like it, share it with somebody. Put it on your radio network. You know, we band all these networks together. We can work together. We can become something that people have never seen before. It's kind of like that united we stand, divided we fall. And we stand together. We are a formidable force. Those folks out there that are the elitist of the world, they can't stand up against a giant such as we the people. When we get tired of it, when we get tired of living that life from birth to grave as the system slaves, then that'll be the time when we make this world right. In the meantime, I got to keep saying what I'm saying. I got to keep doing what I'm doing. I got to keep on trying to convince the world that there is a better way. Because I do believe in the dream. And that's why I do what I do. Mad Science Show, to me, is a whole lot more than meets the eye. And I feel like that if we ever decide to come together, there ain't going to be no problem in this world that we can't resolve. That's as simple as that. Folks, you've been listening to the Mad Science Show. I'll ask you, just like I ask you every single time, share the link, share the podcast. Jump in these chat rooms and talk to one another. And the moment I get my new lab together, you'll be the first to know, I guarantee you that. We'll get this show on the road. I held on to the YouTube channel for as long as I have because I had to find out how serious the world really was. I've held on to this radio station for the same reason. I had to find out how serious this world really was. I shouted it to all four points of the compass. We got the answers. I put the solutions on the table. I put all my pieces of my puzzle on the table. The moment the rest of the world wants to bring their pieces of the puzzle to the table, and we can sit there and we can step back and we can look, we can put all these pieces together, you're going to see a better world. You're going to see more efficient machines. You're going to see better treatment of our environment. And hopefully, when it's all said and done, better treatment of one another. Folks, I've said all I came here to say today. Peace and love. You've been listening to Mad Science.
What is the dream? The dream is to bring brilliant minds from every nation together to solve the world's problems, one positive pebble at a time. It will be we, the people of the world, that bring about true change, peace and love to all. Governments never solve any problem, only create them. Wars, starvation, sickness, oppression, financial slavery, death and destruction is what governments do best. When all the military might of nations is used to destroy other nations, the question has to be asked, why not use that military strength for good? Feed the hungry, shelter the homeless, heal the sick, and so forth. True representation of truth, freedom, and justice comes from we the people, and it never came from slick-talking politicians that say whatever they have to get elected, and then regulate away your freedoms. There is no reason to have starving babies in the world of today. Yet, it goes on. There's no reason for wars and sickness, yet it continues. We as the people must stop feeding that beast that is eating humanity alive. We the people of all nations have the power to bring about a literal heaven on earth. You as an individual have more power than you can possibly imagine. You have the power of the spoken word. You have the power of the pen. The power of action, and most of all, the power of love. It is time to use this power to make our world a better place. We are the founding fathers, mothers, sisters, and brothers of our children, and of our children's children's future. Into the future and beyond, what we do today will define the world that they live in tomorrow. Let us, from every nation, come together and make that future a great one.
It was that ant that stood up to me.
Yeah, but we can forget about him.
Yeah, it was just one ant.
Ooh,
one ant.
Yeah, you're right. It's just one ant.
Yeah, boss, they're puny.
Puny? Say, let's pretend this brain is a puny little ant.
Did that hurt?
Nope.
Well, how about this one?
Are you kidding?
Well, how about this?
You let one ant stand up to us, then they all might stand up.
Those puny little ants outnumber us 100 to 1. And if they ever figure that out, there goes our way of life.
It's not about food. It's about keeping those ants in line. That's why we're going back.
Does anybody else want to stay?
space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission:
to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Crap.
Operator, give me the number for 911.
I got a laptop. I make music with my friends. I've got a laptop, baby. I make music with my friends. There it is.
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch.